So if you were to take hundreds and hundreds of years worth of biblical commentary about the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector, and you mixed it up in one big pot, and you boiled it down over the century, you might get a sermon that goes something like this. Two guys go up to the temple to pray. The Pharisee prays the wrong way. He believes his wealth of good deeds will be an all-access pass to heaven. The sinful tax collector, despised by all, prays the right way. The moral? That it's better to be a repentant Gentile saved by grace than a sanctimonious Jewish high priest trying to achieve salvation through good works. This, unfortunately, has been the way this parable has been interpreted for a long time, and it promotes a works versus grace debate and really kind of an explicit anti-Jewish, anti-temple view. But I'd like to offer you an alternative reading of this parable based on the scholarship of one of my very favorite scholars and one of the finest New Testament scholars in the world. Her name is Amy Jill Levine, and she's Jewish. She's devoted much of her life's work to exhaustive study of the New Testament and Jesus' life, because she says that most of the New Testament was written by Jews and provides insight into contemporaneous Jewish views. Unfortunately, some of its interpretations have led to tragic relations between Jews and Christians over the past two millennia. Levine asserts that this parable might just be such a case. For centuries, this parable has been approached as the story about the temple being a representation of empty piousness or works and a corrupt, bad Judaism that Jesus came to destroy. In contrast, the sinful tax collector is the redeemed Gentile or the Christian saved by grace theory. But these ideas only exist by reinforcing negative stereotypes that first century Jews just simply would not have held. Levine says listeners in Jesus' time would be surprised that a Pharisee would have been dismissive of others in the community, and they would have been just as surprised that a tax collector can be repentant. And they would have been provoked, as we all should be, by the implications of a relationship between these two men. Everyone in Jesus' community would have known that the temple welcomed both sinners and saints. They might have heard some of Jesus' other stories that painted Pharisees in a bad light and tax collectors in a good one. But they would have known that this story would have been completely out of the ordinary. Back then, Pharisees had a reputation as generous and being very pious men. And tax collectors, well, they were kind of seen like drug dealers. They made lots of money dishonestly. So Levine insists that to look at this parable for what it is, we have to resist the urge to say, thank God I'm not like the Pharisees. So if this parable that starts with a super pious Pharisee and a dirty dealing tax collector is not trying to degrade or upgrade anyone's reputation, then what is Jesus trying to tell us? Well, if we know anything about parables, they're never what they appear to be on the surface. Jesus is definitely trying to challenge his listeners then and now, juxtaposing ideas of good and bad and using opposite caricatures to show what we miss when we judge people by their appearances or actions. This parable was directed at, and this is the NRSV version that you didn't hear, some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. Now, given that setup and what we know about human nature, I'm pretty sure that Jesus is talking to all of us. If we use the old interpretation of this parable, that one guy is better than the other, we put limits on the parable's meaning. Levine suggests that we should look at it differently. She reminds us that in the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus tells us that God makes the sun shine on sinners and saints alike, and says that This type of generosity allows the tax collector to tap into the collective repentance of the temple system and even the good deeds of the Pharisee. That's the kind of goodness we want, but sometimes we want to keep that for ourselves because I think that's what Jesus is trying to get at. Therefore, this parable can be seen as an illustration of God's limitless generosity and our inability to want to share it. A modern interpretation of this parable, Levine surmises, is the story of any group project that you've ever been involved with in which different members of the team do different amounts of work. We've all been in this situation at some point in our lives. So here's my example from seminary. I was in a group that was tasked with making a video presentation on the Gospel of John. It's a little daunting, right? So there were four of us in our group, and we divided up the work equally. I agreed to make some of the slides and the material, but then I agreed to take everybody's material and compile it into a video. And my friend got me her images within just a couple of days, and I popped them into the presentation. And then another guy, after a lot, I had to kind of nudge him, but he got me some music and some slides and material. But the last guy, he did pretty much nothing. He partied with his classmates every night. And then the day before the presentation, still didn't have his material. And he was like up at midnight, still partying. And I finally got his slides like in the middle of the night. And the morning before the presentation, I was frantically putting them in. Well, we gave the presentation, and our hungover teammate remarkably rallied. And lo and behold, we made an A on the project. And we were all excited. But when the prodigal teammate wanted to gloat, the rest of us were really miffed. How dare he claim an A that we worked so hard for? The next day, I was meeting with my spiritual advisor, and I told her the story. And she kind of just laughed and shook her head. She said, "Y'all just need to rejoice in that A and let the miraculous generosity of Jesus lift you all up, even that slacker boy." We had been so mad that we had forgot to be grateful. We had been so self-righteous that we had forgotten where all the goodness comes from in the first place. All of our readings today are about giving because God has given to us. Paul tells us, "But the Lord stood by me and gave me strength." And we didn't hear it today, but we will in the next service, the wisdom of Sirach. It says more explicitly, "Give to the Most High as he has given to you, as generously as you can afford." I did not pick these readings. They are in the lectionary. But, spoiler alert, the pledge campaign is coming. These verses are often wrapped around parish giving initiatives because, like our gospel today, they are messages of God's generosity to us. With God's love and promise of his unmatched gift of his son, Jesus Christ, who gives us the gift of salvation. God doesn't discriminate with generosity. God's gift extends to all our communities. Amy Jill Levine reminds us that each one of us has something to contribute, even if what we give is the opportunity for someone else to provide us a benefit. We are all on this earth, clustered together in communities and towns, our schools, our families, our churches. Why not let the miraculous generosity of Jesus lift us all up? Even if we wanted to, it's impossible to keep the fullness of God's love just for ourselves. It fills every corner of the world and extends to Pharisees and tax collectors, saints and sinners alike, with only one expectation: to pass it on.